fifth test starts from Hobart. Adam Collins will be part of your commentary team. He's done a sterling job so far for SEN. I've been enjoying the coverage. He joins us now. Collo, how are you doing?
Great, guys. You know when you get put on hold when you're about to come on a program and you can dip into the show at any old time? I've heard about high horses, reverse Malachi and fishing. So this could go anywhere. Dream team stuff.
Well, we'd like to bring a variety of content to the program. And you've been brought in specifically for cricket, which is an area of your expertise, Sam.
Okay.
And I also like the sport, so we're in a great place.
Collo, let's start with the most important thing. Now, we're 2 days out from the test match. The journos have arrived in Hobart, and that only means one thing, taking photos of the pitch 48 hours out before the game, which means we can all have really informed reads about how it will play. There's two schools of thought. One, it's really, really green because it's 2 days out from the day's play and it's been raining for about 8 years in Hobart. Or two, the game's going to go for 5 days because Hobart really needs it to go for a long time to cash in as much as possible. Which camp are you in?
The latter. I've not seen the photo of the pitch, but I've covered about 100 test matches now, and I know what every pitch looks like 2 days before a test, and it's got grass all over it, and we all post the same photos, and betting enthusiasts all get very excited about what they've seen, and they all tweet to us asking us about the pitch for the next 2 days, and we routinely ignore that bit, and we get on with the show. But by all reports out of Hobart last week, it felt as though they were keen for this to be, I suppose, what you would call in England a chief executive's pitch, a pitch which is going to go the distance to make sure they make maximum revenue. And fair enough, too. I don't suppose after having gone to this effort to get the test played at Hobart, they're going to roll out an actual green top, which could see the test finish in 2.5 days. So logic would suggest the latter.
What's the weather? Because I saw a picture of, I think was the pitch in Hobart, about 6 feet submerged in water. It'll certainly level it up between the two sides, I imagine. It's harder to turn it. It'll be difficult, you know, for Nathan Lyon and Jack Leach with the wet ball. Is it dry? Is it going to be dry?
I reckon the first day's got the worst problems. However, in saying that, I think if we've learned anything through the series, it's to have a fairly healthy scepticism about the radar. It's been off the whole series. Wherever we've gone, we've been making fairly dire predictions. And yeah, we lost 50 overs in Sydney, scattered across the 5 days, but we still got the majority of the test match in. It wasn't washed out as people were forecasting the day before. So based with all those caveats in mind, I think the first day or the first night might have a few issues with rain, but thereafter it should be okay. So we'll work on that basis.
Collo, Usman Khawaja was recalled last test after 3 years in the wilderness and made memorable twin centuries straight away. He replaced Travis Head, who was out through COVID. Travis Head made a match-winning 100 in the first test. You'd imagine he'd come back in. The other spot that seems to be open is Marcus Harris, who has been making, I think, incremental improvements to his game, though his ceiling seems a little bit lower than the other two, though he plays in that specialist position. Do you have any read on what the selectors are going to do vis-a-vis this match and then into the future with three tours into Asia?
Yeah, look, I'd be surprised based on Usman's own comments if they play him. And again, that's not me advocating that he not play. It's just simply that he said after the test that he thought that Harris would play. So if Harris plays, there's really no spot for Khawaja. As you point out, Travis Head will be playing. He'll be coming straight back in. They're not going to dump him on the basis of contracting COVID. So, but really, does it matter a tremendous amount? I don't think it does. The reality is Australia play 9 test matches in Asia starting on the 3rd of March, and Usman Khawaja is going to play in all of them. He averages 318 against spin over the last 4 years at first class level. I mean, absurd. I mean, his reverse sweeping at Sydney was to die for. I mean, this guy, remembering, it's actually quite an interesting story when you consider that he was dumped in Sri Lanka in 2016. He didn't like that, actually. Usman described himself as the scapegoat for that series loss and copped a whack from Matthew Hayden, who said, well, you know, go off and shut up and make some runs. He didn't get picked in India in 2017, the perception being that he wasn't good against spin. In 2017, later in the year, he played one test in Bangladesh and was dropped for the second. So it used to be Khawaja, great for home conditions, not the man for all seasons. Now, it's kind of turned on its head after that epic 100 in Dubai in 2018, where he's seen as Australia's best player of spin, and the stats bear that out. So he'll open at Karachi. He'll get Marcus Harris's spot eventually, barring something quite remarkable this week at Hobart. But, yeah, unless they pull a Swifty. I saw Eddie Cowan advocating that Marnus should open, freeing up a spot in the middle order for Khawaja. I suppose that's your more exotic solution. But I don't think the year of Australian cricket lives and dies on what happens at Hobart this week as far as Usman Khawaja is concerned, because after all that mistreatment and I suppose a dreadfully timed poor run of form in 2018-19 when Smith and Warner were out of the team, he was the senior player and he didn't deliver. And it made him the easy guy to go in England in 2019. Rightly or wrongly, he was the easy guy to drop. And now, 35 years of age, he seems completely at peace with where this is going. And, I mean, those innings were just incredible, weren't they? The first innings was a masterpiece and the second innings was just an absolute joy to watch.
Did you feel, and this must be a very English-centric way of viewing the fourth test, that in some ways it not only was a great draw for England, but it basically made test cricket good again. And it meant that test cricket had been saved. And actually what England have done over the last month or so has been a glorious thing because they failed so many times. So when they finally came back, it was like salvaging a draw from the jaws of defeat was actually better for the whole sport. So England have done the whole sport a favour.
Well, I'll jump in, Sam. I think there's been a lot of great test cricket played this year already, but we just didn't have a great series in Australia. I mean, it got to the final session in Adelaide, but it always felt like it would have been an utter miracle had England held on. But, I mean, Bangladesh knocking off New Zealand in the first test and that fabulous series that's playing out between South Africa and India, it's a reminder that test cricket's actually in quite good health at the moment. It's just this series is rubbish, and it's been rubbish in Australia for the most part since 1982-83. So we shouldn't be dreadfully surprised that there's a mismatch here, especially with the conversation we were having last week about England's dreadful preparation and various other mitigating factors with this particular series. But you're right, there is something very special about holding on and grasping a draw from the jaws of defeat. I suppose that's something that sets test cricket apart, that you can be behind for the majority of the 5 days and still hold on. And they did so due to some gutsy batting. And that's what we've been asking for 3.5 test matches. When are England going to step up and be counted? And at 4 for 36 in the first innings, it didn't look that way. Enter Johnny Bairstow, probably one of the proudest moments of his international career on day three and really important on day five as well. I mean, they earned the draw. And I remember Jason Holder said a couple of years ago when they were in Australia, his team were rubbish. And his view was that the West Indies need to learn how to not lose before they win. I think there's a little bit about that in the England team right now. They needed to not lose first, and then now they can sort of reset and look at trying to win test cricket in the West Indies in the next series. I don't expect they'll win this week, but they've been able to stabilise somewhat at least.
I think a lot of us have been talking about why this draw was so enjoyable. Maybe it was enjoyable against the backdrop of three very heavy defeats prior to it, but I think as life becomes faster and our memories become more like goldfish and we just scroll the internet all the time, it actually then brings into focus how good a test cricket draw is, because it becomes more and more the opposite of everyday life. Like, did you know, I looked up a definition of tantric lovemaking the other day. Is this okay?
Yeah, fine.
It's a
fine.
Slow meditative form where it's not about the end goal, but enjoying the journey and sensations of the body. And I think test cricket and that particular draw was quite similar to that. And I think that's the phenomenon that is making us reflect so deeply on why we enjoyed a winnerless draw on a grubby SCG pitch in a dead rubber.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't necessarily instantly, while I was watching Jimmy Anderson bat out that over from Steve Smith, I didn't instantly go to tantric sex.
No.
But
you do now.
I do now, but it did make me think, actually, the beauty of it is, right now, I don't care that we've lost the last three, right? I don't feel that this series is over. I don't feel like it's done. I feel like that this matters. And I guess sport, ultimately, and maybe it's dangerous to say it on a sports radio station, we deep down, we know that sport doesn't matter. So we're constantly conning ourselves that it all matters, right? I was up at 4 a.m. watching Cambridge United beat Newcastle and crying, right? Yeah. But ultimately, it doesn't matter. You know, life carries on. So maybe it's just, that's what I felt. I was watching this game and I was so engrossed in it, and I'd completely forgotten the disaster that had happened up to this point. I want to ask you, Colo, about, you're talking about the bad prep that England had, and I heard Jimmy Anderson on my second favourite cricket podcast, Tail Enders, which is not as good as The Great Cricketer. But I...
Or Colo's won the final word.
Oh, sorry, my third favourite.
Good on you, Max. Good on you, buddy.
I like that Jeff Lemon. He's good, that one. I like him. My third favourite cricketing podcast. But he was sort of saying, look, the preparation's been so bad. Is there a way of granting, and I don't know who's... Obviously, it was COVID impacted, but Is there a way of, because the Australians don't really want England to have great prep because they want to win, but wouldn't it be better to have really good preparation to give them like really good first-class games, and then the series might be tighter and we'd have a more interesting series?
Oh, look, this has been going on for 20 years, that prep's been getting worse and worse. It's just more acute this time because they didn't need to do 14 days of quarantine on the Gold Coast. What it boils down to is that Cricket Australia had their schedule out with Brisbane being the first test match. They wanted to get England at the Gabba straight up, and they, as a consequence, had to quarantine because Queensland wasn't open at that particular juncture. I was saying all along, my view was that that's ridiculous. Let them play the first test match in a state that's open, come back to the Gabba later in the series in the interests of fairness and making sure that the prep was as good as could be. For Australia as well, by the way. I mean, remember, they're a bunch of world... Half that team are world champions from the T20 World Cup in mid-November. And in order, and the way they celebrated that in hotel quarantine, or a version of hotel quarantine anyway, that was arranged by the Queensland government. So, yeah, I think that no first-class cricket, half a warm-up game in the wet, after England had been pretty much bubble to bubble for the better part of 2 years. They were on a hiding to nothing. It doesn't detract from the systemic problems that are going to be reviewed, as they routinely are when England get pumped in Australia. That's kind of part of the cycle that we go to next. How will they regroup? Who will they regroup under? Who has to be sacked and so on? But I think it'd be disingenuous to say that that England were ever a meaningful chance of coming here and doing well at the start, given they played literally no cricket, or no proper cricket, before they faced the first ball at Brisbane. And then you fold in all the strategic mistakes, the team they played at Brisbane, even the very fact that they batted first on a green top. It showed how frazzled they were. And then once Australia got the wind behind their back, they were always going to do something like this.
Colo, it's my favourite topic, Justin Langer watch. Obviously, Australia's won the series, so we now must focus not on what comes next, but also on the series ahead and the future beyond. His contract's up in June. They did say unofficially that they'd just review it after the Ashes. And there's a report in The Guardian today from Ali Martin, and it made the back pages of the Guardian, broadsheet in the UK as well, that Trevor Bayliss, the former England head coach, has emerged as the in-house favourite to take charge of the Australian men's team. I just found that interesting, mate, insofar as Ali wouldn't be reporting those things unless it was very, very well-sourced. And are there people within the Australian team softening the nation up for an inevitable change, even though Langer's won the T20 World Cup and this Ashes series?
Yeah, I think in order for Langer to have been reappointed straight up, it was like, well, here's the bar. You've got to win the World Cup in the UAE and you've got to flog England. Well, they're actually going to do both of those things. And I don't think anyone really expected the first to happen. So it does complicate matters somewhat. When Pat Cummins was asked this question, I think it was after the Melbourne Test match, he gave a pretty straight answer without endorsing Langer just to get re-signed. And maybe you'd expect the captain to give an answer that was a bit more bullish than Cummins. So that's a bit of a tell, I reckon, that the playing group are happy just to ride through the process. I'm not at all surprised that Trevor Bayliss is in the conversation, though. Let's look at who was the state coach when players like Smith and Warner and Khawaja were coming through. The formative years for them at New South Wales, it was all under Trevor Bayliss, and they've got, by all reports, great relationships with him. So the fact that he's back and he's on the BBL circuit and he's so highly credentialed as a white ball coach, it wouldn't shock me at all if they offered him some sort of chance to work in the Australian system. And maybe if they split the jobs, if they went with a red ball coach and a white ball coach, that Bayliss, with the success he enjoyed with England, winning the World Cup in 2019, he might be a great fit, especially with this particular generation of Australian cricketers that played at New South Wales. So yeah, that all stands to reason. And as you say, the fact that Ali's popped it on the back page would suggest that it's pretty well sourced.
What power to just pop it on the back page himself. I've been desperately trying to get back page of the Guardian. Never. I'm always like, five pages in. What an outrage. Colo, thanks, mate.
Anytime, guys.